Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, President Obama stood before reporters on national television prime time for his first full-dress press conference and gravely warned of worse to come in the economy if a stimulus isn't passed soon.
Even greater job loss, even greater loss of income, and even greater loss of confidence. Those are deficits that could turn a crisis into a catastrophe, and I refuse to let that happen.
Catastrophe, not a word presidents use lightly. And today, there's more on the American financial system. This hour, On Point, Obama in the crucible and the big push from stimulus to banking bailout. We will hear in a moment on the banking plan from former IMF chief economist Raghuram Rajan, who warned early of the crisis in finance. But let's hear a little more first of Barack Obama yesterday, President Obama at a town hall-style meeting in Elkhart, Indiana, campaigning for that stimulus package. He went on the offensive against Republicans resisting his efforts. He said inaction would lead to dire consequences.
More people will lose their homes and their health care. And our nation will sink into a crisis that at some point we may be unable to reverse. So we can't afford to wait. We can't wait and see and hope for the best. We can't posture and bicker and resort to the same failed ideas that got us into this mess in the first place. That was what this election was all about. The American people rejected those ideas because they hadn't worked.
Into a crisis that at some point we may be unable to reverse. In the glory of the White House last night, first question was on exactly this point. Hear from Jennifer Levin of the Associated Press.
Do you think that you risk losing some credibility or even talking down the economy by using dire language like that?
No. I think that what I've said is what other economists have said across the political spectrum, which is that if you delay acting on an economy of this severity, then you potentially create a negative spiral that becomes much more difficult for us to get out of. We saw this happen in Japan in the 1990s, where they did not act, and as a consequence, they suffered what was called the lost decade.
A lost decade? Obama doesn't want it. Joining us now from Washington is Gerald Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal. He writes the journal's Capital Journal column. He's co-author of the book Pennsylvania Avenue. Jerry, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
You watched Obama last night. How is he doing in this crucible?
Well, I think he does pretty well in the environment that we saw him in last night, the press conference environment, talking policy and trying to translate policy into the sort of language people understand. It's one of the reasons he's president is that he does that well, sort of in the same way I always thought Bill Clinton did it in his day. So I think on that level, I think he did quite well, and my guess is he did himself and his stimulus package some good in terms of public opinion last night. In terms of the actual legislative process, I think the die is pretty well cast. It's going to happen. It's going to happen with almost no Republican votes, and it'll be done probably in the next 2 weeks, and it will be seen as a Democratic stimulus plan, and everybody will live with the political consequences of that.
Was there ever a real chance of having this be a bipartisan plan, Jerry?
That is a really good question, and I suspect that people, when they write the histories of this period, will speculate about that without any of us ever knowing for sure the answer. Republicans say that if the original bill in the House had been constructed differently, which is to say if it hadn't been written by House Democrats who put a lot of their favorite spending programs in there, and if the White House and President Obama had constructed their own stimulus program less tilted toward the kinds of government spending Republicans don't like, that maybe it would have turned out differently. It's also possible, and you know, the president got at this last night in the press conference a couple of times, that there's simply a philosophical difference right now that hasn't been resolved in spite of all the talk of bipartisanship, which is a difference about the role of government, about the role of government at a time like this. You know, the Democrats think big and quick action by the government is necessary to pull the economy out of this kind of a rut, and Republicans aren't so convinced. And maybe there's a philosophical divide there that was simply more basic than everybody acknowledged at the outset.
We'll look more at that. Another shoe dropping today. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, in prepared remarks out this morning, already saying without credit, economies cannot grow. And right now, critical parts of our financial system are damaged. He's going to be today unfolding that, and we'll be hearing about it all through this week. The first part of the so-called TARP program came in for a lot of criticism, Gerald Seib. What kind of reception do you expect in Congress for part two?
In a way, it doesn't matter because the money is there. The only question is, how is the Obama administration going to spend it? I think the question really becomes, can public support for this whole enterprise be rebuilt, and therefore would there be political support in Congress if, it, as seems at least possible, if not likely, down the road, the president has to come back to seek more money for this enterprise of keeping the financial system solvent? That's the real issue, I think, on the table. And there will be a need, I think, by the Treasury Secretary, Mr. Geithner, and the president over the coming days and weeks to present this as a plan that will work differently, that is different in its concept than the original TARP plan was under the Bush administration, because that one has essentially failed the test of public support.
Jerry, you've watched Washington for a long time, and now here we are with a new president, a new majority party. Do you think it matters in terms of policy effectiveness whether there is a bipartisan embrace here or whether it, you know, sort of sorts out into a Democratic recovery effort versus Republican criticism? Does it matter?
I do think it matters because it sets the tone for a lot of what I think will come in the rest of the Obama term. I mean, I think about two precedents here. The Reagan precedent at the beginning of the Reagan administration, he passed what was then seen as a very radical economic plan of tax cuts and spending cuts and military budget increases with a fair amount of Democratic support. And that basically set the tone of Ronald Reagan as a guy who could command Democratic as well as Republican votes in Congress and in the country. And by contrast, you had Bill Clinton at the outset of his term passing a big economic plan with literally no Republican support and barely enough Democratic support. And that, I think, also set a tone that it was kind of open partisan warfare. And that, I believe, continued for a while as well. So I do think it matters. Whether it's better or worse is up to the beholder. I do think tone is one thing that is being set right now, and that will be influenced greatly by the way the stimulus debate turns out.
He was maintaining that open tone last night, even as he expressed determination that this must, will go through. Jerry Seib, stand by. Lots of listeners who want straight in on this. Kalamazoo, Michigan. Nicole, you're on the air, Nicole.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment about his strategy right now, Barack Obama's a strategy.
Yeah.
I feel that he was elected by the people to help change politics and to try and make a government that was meeting the needs of the people. Our tax dollars are supposed to go towards things that benefit the people. And this economic stimulus plan, the idea is that it's supposed to be benefiting us in a time of need. So I don't see why there's even a question that they should be doing what he's recommending. Plus, he was elected by the people who have faith in his judgment, for his judgment.
Is he right to use the dire language, Nicole?
Oh, you know, initially when I saw that, I was standing in a Radio Shack, and I was just looking at the TV, and I was a little bit irritated by that at first because I thought it was going to cause a snowball effect and create panic and fear and then worsen things. But on the other hand, when I thought about it, you know, I realized that he's fighting a political battle against Republicans, and his goal is to get this economic stimulus package passed, and he's doing it for a purpose, and that is to try to help the economy and the people who elected him.
Nicole,
so I feel like if he has to use those types of strategies, I'm all okay with it. He needs to convince the Republicans this is serious and get the people to realize that the Republicans are holding them back.
Nicole in Kalamazoo, let me get an economist's view of that. From Chicago, Raghuram Rajan joins us, professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Professor Rajan, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Dire language from the president in Elkhart and again in Washington last night. We could sink into a crisis that at some point we may be unable to reverse. As an economist, how do you hear that? Is that accurate? Is that, does it sound politically wise, the right spur in the side?
Well, it's clearly intended to prompt action, political action. He has a dual role here. One is to build confidence in the economy over time. This is what the famous Roosevelt, the only thing we have to fear itself, tried to do. While, on the other hand, he has to actually take the actions that will allow the economy to come out. And clearly, he's now focused on the second part, which is how do we make sure that the actions are indeed taken?
Jerry Seib, in the aftermath of the press conference last night, the sound around Washington today, do you hear camps coalescing where they're going to go, you know, hammer and tongs battle over this? Don't the Republicans also feel that with the very serious economic circumstances that are out there, doing nothing can look bad?
I think what you're hearing is continued rhetoric about willingness to reach across the aisle. I mean, that was certainly what Republicans were trying to say last night. I think you have to separate the rhetoric from the reality under these circumstances. Is that really likely to happen? Or, as I said earlier, has the die been cast? I think it is the view of most people here that now the die has been cast. This will pass kind of the way it's being passed. There are important decisions to make to reconcile what the House has done and what the Senate has done, and those are important to maintain the votes of those three Republican senators who did support it in the Senate and whose votes are still needed for final passage. But compared to the sort of the grander disagreements here, those changes are pretty much in the margin, I believe. And I suspect we're down to a political gamble on both sides. The Democrats gambling that this kind of stimulus package will work and will be seen as having worked, and Republicans gambling that it's not popular, is losing popularity, and will be seen in the long run as a mistake.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama, the economy, and the banking bailout, where it's all headed. Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor of the Wall Street Journal, joins us from Washington. And from Chicago, economist Raghuram Rajan, professor of finance at the University of Chicago, chief economist, former chief economist at the IMF until 2006. He was one of those who voiced loud and early warnings. Here was President Obama last night pushing back against Republicans who have said the stimulus package is full of unnecessary spending.
What I've been concerned about is some of the language that's been used, suggesting that this is full of pork and this is wasteful government spending, so on and so forth. First of all, when I hear that from folks who presided over a doubling of the national debt, I just want them to not engage in some revisionist history. I inherited the deficit that we have right now and the economic crisis that we have right now.
I inherited this deficit, says the president, Dave, in Wagner, South Carolina. You're on the air, Dave.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm getting pretty upset about the way Obama keeps constantly railing against the Republicans. You know, he wants bipartisan support, and he makes it look like the Republicans are totally the bad guys, when bipartisan, it's a two-party system. We give you this bill, you don't like it, you put in what you want, it goes back and forth, that's healthy government.
Yet but we did have Republican majority control for most of the last 8 years, Dave. I guess that's what he's pointing to, right?
Well, he's pointing to that, but he also is the agent of change. Mm-hmm. Okay, and now that, because the Republicans won't rubber stamp his bill, they're the ones causing all this grief in America. And I don't think that's necessarily the case, really. I was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. George Bush cured me of that. I voted for Obama, and all I see him doing is backpedaling, you know, on a bunch of other issues, but this one in particular. You can't, when they had that weekend retreat, he's there just railing the Republicans. They don't want, you know, they want to hold this thing up, and it's...
But then he's got a hand reaching out at the same time. It's an interesting picture. Let's take it to The Economist first. Raghuram Rajan, how do you see this? Gerald Seib says maybe what we're going to have here, after all the talk about bipartisanship, is just boiling down to a sort of a philosophical Donnybrook, a grand philosophical debate. Is this the time for that, Professor?
Well, it's very hard to get everybody on board, partly because economists themselves are not in agreement about the effectiveness of many of the measures being proposed in the stimulus. I think people, for example, question the effectiveness of the tax rebates, whether they'll just be saved or whether they'll be spent. Others question the effectiveness of spending, especially on infrastructure, which is going to come in 2 or 3 years down the line. It's not clear there are so many effective shovel-ready projects to go. So there is a fair amount of debate, and to argue that there's unanimity in the both in the economics profession and among politicians about what the necessary steps are is to overstate the case. So I think some political debate is useful, and to label one side or the other as being partisan in this case is probably not wise, because I think there are legitimate differences in opinion.
Jerry Seib, Obama last night saying, look, he's in this for the long haul, for the whole term and maybe more, and he's not going to gauge Republican response just by these first couple of 3 weeks. At the same time, our caller reminds us of that retreat in Williamsburg, Virginia. Obama was tougher there with Democrats. But of course, he's got demands from that side of the block, too. Democrats saying, yes, indeed, we won, and we want to do this in a democratic way, Jerry.
Well, a couple of things. You know, Republicans tend to view Democrats in Congress right now as being more partisan than the president himself is. I think their view, and this is reflected in their rhetoric, and part of it's tactical, but part of it is what they really believe, is that if they were dealing only with President Obama, there would be more movement toward the middle, probably a greater openness to Republican ideas than there has been dealing with Democrats in Congress. So that's item one. Item two is the president has been, from the beginning here, juggling two goods, two goals. One is to do this stimulus quickly, because I think that his economic team really does believe something needs to happen quickly, because the slide downward is broad and could be deep unless something is done to change the psychology. And that goal has been juggled with and in conflict with the idea of getting some bipartisanship, which is slower and messier. And I think what happened last week at Williamsburg was the president reached the point where he just decided if he had to choose between getting something done quickly and getting something done with more Republican votes, the circumstances in his judgment required quickness. So that's what you got.
And quickness and the push. Let's go to Richard in Laurel, New York. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of there seems to be a lot of emphasis, particularly by the press, about bipartisanship. You know, but at the end of the day, the American public doesn't really care that much about politics. What they care about is jobs. What they care about is getting the economy growing again. What they care about is credit. I'm a small business owner. I have had such a difficult time trying to get the even just a Small Business Administration loan, which is partially guaranteed by the government. You know, I don't care if no Republicans vote for it or if 100 Republicans vote for it. You know, what we care about is getting the economy going. And I think that the politics, it seems like that's the sport that a lot of the press gets really caught up in. What we care about is results. And you know, I favor Obama. If he's going to, he has to stand behind what he believes in. If he doesn't do that, he's going to be judged on it no matter what. So why not go with what you believe in?
Richard, we hear that loud and clear. And let me go to Raghuram Rajan on exactly that. Professor Rajan, here's a small businessman. He's feeling the credit squeeze, the credit freeze firsthand. We're going to be hearing a lot about the second shoe falling in the bank bailout this week. Timothy Geithner out talking about it today. How should we look at what Geithner is unfolding here, Professor Rajan? What are you going to be looking at most closely?
Well, first, of course, is the objective, and I think the objective suggested by your caller is the right one. How do we get credit picking up again? There are large parts of the financial system outside the banking system which have stopped lending, and to some extent, the banking system has to pick up to compensate for that. And we need to figure out how to do that. So I think that's the metric by which one should judge the success of the plan. 6 months from now, do banks feel comfortable enough to start lending again? Of course, they're not going to lend as freely as before because economic conditions have turned. I would say we sort of keep hearing about the three T's by which the fiscal stimulus is being judged. I would say there are four C's by which we should judge Timothy Geithner's plan. First, is it clear? Does it tell us what is going to happen to whom and when? Second, is it comprehensive? Does it deal with the entire financial system as opposed to small healthy parts or small unhealthy parts? Third, is it cost effective? How much is it going to cost the taxpayer? How much are the existing investors in banks going to be bailed in to provide some of the cost of this bailout plan? And finally, is it credible? Does it have political support? Are people going to put their call their politician and say vote for it? And does the market believe that it is actually going to work? So I think these are the elements by which it has to be judged. I think there are three main sort of proposals on the table. One is to recapitalize banks with some sort of preferred equity stake, which the government will take, with the emphasis being if they can recapitalize by issuing directly in the markets to private investors, they should do that.
So a combination of government funds and private funds on the recapitalization.
Mm-hmm. Yes, with the government not taking a direct equity position, but sort of staying on the sidelines with this convertible preferred and only converting it to equity if the bank is in a dire situation. So we will not see the kind of nationalization that some people have been talking about. Second, something to take the toxic assets off the bank balance sheet. So there are lots of bad assets on bank balance sheets because nobody knows how much they're worth.
And they're worth less than they were is the number one assumption.
Absolutely. They're worth less than they were. They're probably worth less than what the banks are carrying them at.
Mm-hmm.
So outside investors are quite reluctant to put money into banks, knowing that tomorrow the money they put in might be wiped out by the bank declaring yet more losses on these toxic assets. So there is a need to somehow either take them off the balance sheet or segregate them. And I think the current proposals that have been leaked out suggest some form of aggregator bank or some government-supported entity which will buy these assets off the banks. But this is the part which is most vague and probably the most important. And the third, of course, is that they're going to encourage the Fed to buy more financial assets in the market, something it's already been doing, and that will also be part of the plan. The fourth, which seems to be more of an afterthought at this point, but is quite important for political support, is what to do with the foreclosures, whether the mortgages are going to be modified in bankruptcy by bankruptcy judges. And I think that is something that we want to wait and see.
Jerry Seib with The Wall Street Journal, I know I just have you for another minute. This has been leaking out for a couple of days now. How is it being received? Are we seeing something significantly different from what Hank Paulson, George Bush's Treasury Secretary, gave us with TARP 1 in TARP 2? Or is this a continuation? Do you see a turn or more of the same?
I think it's different in the sense that it seems to be much more clearly defined. The sense is you're going to have an assault on all fronts, but those fronts are going to be clearly defined, and there's going to be certainty about where the money is going and why. And that's different. I think a lot of the Paulson-Bush use of the TARP funds seemed to be kind of a rolling decision-making process that changed day-to-day, week-to-week. I think what Tim Geithner is trying to say here is, well, I'm going to give you clarity. We're going to move on all fronts, but I'm going to describe those things, and you can rest assured that that's how this money is going to be spent.
Jerry Seib, executive Washington editor of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for being with us, Jerry.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Let's get a call from Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I hear two things which I think are encouraging, at least what's being leaked now.
Mm-hmm.
As been mentioned, some of the major problems under Paulson were they really seemed to misdiagnose the problem. They were treating it like a illiquidity crisis where nobody is giving credit because they have all these great assets. They just can't sell them because there's no money. So if you pump in some money, it clears everything up. The problem is that there's a huge amount of insolvency out there. Depending on who you read on Bloomberg, the entire U.S. banking system is insolvent, and it's going to take either $2 or $4 trillion to clean up all this stuff, and a lot of people have to go bankrupt. And so now what I hear coming out is they do seem to recognize this. They're not going to form this quote unquote bad bank and make taxpayers overpay for these insolvent assets, which is what essentially Japan tried to do and prolong their crisis because they didn't get at the root of the problem. And the other issue is just the nutty notion that the government can somehow step in and sweep back the ocean by putting a floor in home prices. It's like saying, it's the dot-com burst, but we really need pet.com stock to be as high as it was, so we're gonna buy up all this pet.com stock and fix everything. That's just never going to happen. And that's you heard a lot of that kind of, you know, frankly, crazy thinking previously, and I see that going away. So I think that it's still going to be rough, but those are two encouraging signs.
An encouraged view there. And, Steve, thanks for your call. Raghuram Rajan, let's go first to this issue of what taxpayers might end up paying for these bad assets. Do you see the private money that Geithner is trying to draw in here as somehow regulating that, keeping a real market eye on those prices so that they're not overpriced or underpriced, so that taxpayers are, in fact, protected?
Well, this is what is least clear at this point, and I hope he makes it clear in his speech or in the weeks to come. Because if the private investors were willing to enter this market and buy, they would already be there. So essentially, they're waiting for some sort of support from the government. And what is not clear is what kind of support the government is going to give them. Is it going to take some of the downside risk? That is, if the assets lose value beyond a certain point, the government will pick up the tab. That's a kind of loss-sharing agreement. But what does the government get in return? Is it going to get some of the upside? And how much of the upside if these assets do well? This is something which is really critical, because to get the private sector coming into buying these assets in a big way, at a reasonable price, and a price calculated to not be a huge loss for the banks, some sort of arrangement is likely to be put in place, and so that the taxpayer doesn't have a big hit. That thing has to be priced effectively, and we know nothing about that as of now.
Well, we'll know more soon in the days to come. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska, and Diane. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that last question was really interesting, because that's the key. But I wanted to say that I think what we're seeing here is we're tending toward a paradigm shift in the whole ethos we've had that we will do virtually anything to support the financial system that we've had over the last 38 years. There's been a real attitude of appeasement in Washington toward the financial system, and I think that what we're
anything
we're,
for Wall Street that sort of view?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the Federal Reserve over the last 38 years, they've done everything they can to keep interest rates low, and they're so concerned with inflation and that sort of thing.
A lot of Americans enjoyed that on the way up when the market was growing, when we had growth.
A lot of them did, but then we're seeing that a lot of them didn't. And I think that what we're seeing now is that the gap that widened for an awful lot of people in the United States, and those are the people that we don't hear about in the media. We don't see them unless something like Katrina happens. And I think that this change is going to be really difficult for Democrats to handle, as we've already seen.
Why Democrats? Because they're also because taking
they're
money from...
They're going to think that they've been let loose in the candy store. And it's also going to be very difficult for Republicans, because the whole idea that that the financial system is going to rule our policies and politics henceforward... is a very, very difficult thing. It strikes at the very the principles of the Republican.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Raghuram Rajan joins us from Chicago, Illinois, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Raised big questions very early about the amount of risk that American finance was taking on, and not just American. Also joining us right now from New York City is Diane Brady, senior editor at Business Week magazine. Diane, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So what is Wall Street going to be listening for and watching, you know, weighing as everybody digests this big new Geithner plan today, Diane?
Well, one of the things people have been very curious about is how punitive this plan is going to be to executives. And the indication we get is not very punitive at all, actually, in terms of pay, in terms of replacing top management, and certainly in terms of any sort of pain to be felt by shareholders, at least in the short term. So I think Wall Street at least will greet this as very good news.
Punitive, and yet we heard the $500,000 salary cap for those taking big bucks. Does that not sound punitive, or is it seen
that,
as...
That is for the very top, and that is also mm-hmm. something that will be very easy to game. That is salary, and we know many people, of course, who take $1 in salary and receive a lot in stock. I think it's the right strategy. It probably won't play as well to Main Street, since there is this real visceral anger out there about what the banks have been doing. But the most important thing is they're going to really try to get these assets off the bank's books. And one of the things, one way to sell it to the public, of course, is to rename the plan. And so I think what we're hearing is it's going to be called by a new name. Instead of TARP 2, it'll be the Financial Stability Plan. And it's supposed to be a new day, essentially, and this will hopefully, at the very least, get some lending going again.
Raghuram Rajan, our economist who's been watching for a long time, New York Times reporting today that there was heated debate about how punitive, how tough to be on banking executives, that Timothy Geithner, the new Treasury Secretary, resisted. Those including David Axelrod, senior advisor to the president, who wanted to dictate how banks would spend their rescue money, who wanted to replace bank executives, maybe wipe out shareholders at institutions receiving aid. Does it have the right feeling to you, Professor, that Geithner prevailed in resisting some of these, apparently, some of these harsher measures?
Well, we'll know in a few weeks, because I think there is some political benefit to the punitive measures, because I think much of the American public is fed up with one-way rewards for financial executives. If it does well, you get a lot of money. If it does poorly, well, the government bails you out. And people are now sort of looking at their salaries, which haven't moved for 20 years, and looking at their stock portfolios, which are awful, and if they have one, and of course at their house prices, which are, again, terrible. And they're trying to figure out what have they actually improved over the last 20 years. So in this kind of environment, I think going light on the banking system, which is probably an economically wise thing to do, may not play well on Main Street. And part of this is a political game to get people to put enough support behind the billions and perhaps even trillions of dollars that are still needed to rescue the banking system.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner saying in his prepared remarks, instead of catalyzing recovery, the financial system is working against recovery. And that's the dangerous dynamic we need to change. President Obama, here he is last night saying the banking bailout known as TARP needed big revisions.
That means having some transparency and oversight in the system. It means that we correct some of the mistakes with TARP that were made earlier, the lack of consistency, the lack of clarity in terms of how the program was going to move forward. It means that we condition taxpayer dollars that are being provided to banks on them showing some restraint when it comes to executive compensation, not using the money to charter corporate jets when they're not necessary. It means that we focus on housing and how are we going to help homeowners that are suffering foreclosure or homeowners who are still making their mortgage payments but are seeing their property values decline.
Diane Brady is with us from Businessweek magazine in New York City, and Raghuram Rajan from the University of Chicago. Let's get a call from Nashville and Neil. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just have a couple of quick questions. I'm hoping that your guest can shed some light on what I perceive to be incongruities in the bailout package for the banks. The first one being, it seems, at least in the mechanics of the loans to the banks, or they're buying a preferred stock,
mm-hmm.
and that's supposed to capitalize these banks to stimulate the credit market. But what I've heard from calling shows like this and from banks is that the loan interest rates, or the interest rates they have to pay back to the federal government, are large. larger than what they can actually get in the consumer market by lending at this point. So it's not incentivizing them to release that money into the credit market. And especially, I guess, the second incongruity I perceive from a consumer standpoint is it seems like that everyone agrees that our economy is propped up by consumer spending to a large degree, and that we are leaning on consumers to get back into the market as consumers to get the economy going, but very little is being done to, I guess, trickle down to the consumer in terms of direct help. I'd like to hear your guests shine some light on that, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Neil, let us pick those up. Diane Brady, first to you. In terms of how the bankers are going to be looking at this deal and what it's going to take to get them lending again, what do you see? What do you hear, Diane?
I think the biggest issue with lending has been the fact that they've had a lot of uncertainty about their own financial health. Nobody's going to go out there and lend money, when they're not sure about the external environment, and also when they've got all these assets on their balance sheet. So I think that's the first issue. With regard to the consumer, we have been relying on the American consumer. I think it's one of the biggest debates in these plans is the degree to which you can kickstart the consumer again. There's been a lot of skepticism. I've heard people aren't inclined to buy houses and cars at the moment, so tax incentives on that front probably isn't going to spur a lot of buying, especially when they're unclear whether they'll have a job for the next few months.
Raghuram Rajan, how do you look at this challenge of getting banks to lend again when they don't know what their own assets may be valued at, when they don't know what other banks are asking, and they don't know the forward earning potential, let's say, of a small business or an individual because the economy is so bad, who knows where it ends. Do you see emerging here a structure that banks can stand on and say, all right, here's a loan?
Right. That will take time. First, of course, one must understand what the government is doing is giving these guys equity. That equity forms the base of which they can borrow much more. So,
giving them equity, the government's buying equity,
buying some equity in them
to give them capital.
Mm-hmm. It's giving them capital, so that capital forms the base of which they can borrow far more, and their borrowing costs are still quite low. So, the point that your caller made about the cost of funding being high for them is not quite right in the sense that the banks could actually afford to pass on that lower cost of borrowing once they have a capital base of which to borrow more. The real concern they have is certainly one about the quality of the borrowers at this point with, you know, retail with individuals losing jobs, with companies closing down. So they do have some worries about that. They have worries about their own health. You know, they may run out of capital if the losses do mount over time. But there's a third issue, which is that if parts of the banking system are in danger of failing, it probably makes more sense to wait and see what they're selling when they get into trouble and buy those assets cheaply in the market than make long-term loans. As one of the bank CEOs recently said, why should I make a five-year loan at 5 or 6% interest when I can buy it at half the price in the market? So the point really here is that the distress of the financial system is feeding on itself. As people expect more fire sales, they're unwilling to buy or to lend at this point, trying to keep their powder dry so that when those fire sales actually happen, they have enough money to buy the goodies at a low price. So this is why I think it's quite important to get the comprehensive plan out there and working as fast as possible.
Diane Brady, the president was asked last night whether there might be more billions to come in terms of bailing out the banks. He sort of danced around that. What are you hearing on that front? Here's another $350 billion, the second half of TARP. More to come? Much more to come?
I think the expectation is there will be much more to come. I mean, the big question is whether he can stimulate or save as many jobs as he wants to. I mean, GM this morning announced another 10,000 job cuts. So if the economy takes a turn for the worse, which many think it will, there's a very good chance they'll have to come back and put more money into the system. That's been one of the debates, whether the size of this plan is sufficient to really get us back on track.
Professor Rajan, is there a point at which there is no more money to throw into this hole, or can the government endlessly feed the beast until it's full and ready to work?
Well, it's one of those funny situations. If you feed the beast enough, it won't cost you that much. If you feed it too little, it's money down a black hole. So if
Because you don't fix it, because it doesn't get up and work again.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. If you can put money into the banks and these so-called toxic assets, which are trading at low values, recover in price, the overall bailout bill may be far lower than the current estimates floating around are. And, in fact, the government, you know, quite possibly could make money, though I think that's, at this point, a very low probability event. But on the other hand, if you do partial fixes and it doesn't fix the problem, the economy continues to deteriorate, assets continue to fall in value, well, it's money down a black hole. So this is one of those situations where you need to do it big, need to do it comprehensive, and do it right and cross your fingers and hope it works.
Let's get another call from Nashville. John in Nashville, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
First, a comment and then a question. Mm-hmm. My comment is people seem to keep talking about Paulson and Bush, and Obama was very much a part of this initial bailout plan. I remember him saying that if your neighbor's house is on fire, you put the fire out first. Well, I have a response. If you have to know what kind of fire it is, you put water in a gas fire, you're just going to make it worse. And that's what this TARP bailout has done. It's made the situation worse. My question is, has anybody gone back and looked to see how the government structure has helped create the problem? And, FDR created Fannie Mac, and that turned out to be a government-sponsored entity under Johnson, which means they were free from regulation, and they were able to get into the derivatives market, and that's what created a lot of the problem. And, you know, they had 70% of the home market at one point, and when they went under, and also the San Francisco Chronicle predicted that we'd have this problem. When in the stimulus under Bush, they forced Fannie Mae to up its credit limit, so they had gotten into more bad debt.
John, our time's growing short, but let us pick up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What about it? Raghuram Rajan, you spoke up a couple years ago now, asking about the whole financial system and the increasing sort of sophistication and nuance, and said, has financial development made the world riskier? Famous speech of yours when Alan Greenspan was being honored in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. That was a big kind of rock in the pond you threw there. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, how much do you trace back to their work on housing, and how much to the wider Wall Street evolution in recent years in terms of setting up this instability?
Well, there's enough blame to spread around. I think Wall Street, with its incentive structures, bonus structures, was partly to blame. I certainly think some of the government intervention through Fannie and Freddie was partly responsible. Some of the political desire to spread housing around and therefore turn a blind eye to the fact that credit was being given to people who couldn't actually afford it. There's enough blame. And I think looking forward, this is the calm before the storm that will take us in terms of changing the system. I think politicians at this point are biding their time, trying to help in making the system stabilize. But once we've stabilized, I think everybody is going to be out with their little axe to having their little axe to grind on what parts of the system they want to change, and we have to be very, very careful that we do it right.
Diane Brady, this is where it really gets interesting. On the other side of all these steps in Washington, then exactly the eye turns back to Wall Street. The question is: it going to be like it was before? And if not, then what? What scale of change are you feeling anticipation of in New York, Diane?
One thing that I'm certainly hearing from many CEOs, not just on Wall Street, but, for example, Jeff Immelt of GE as well, is government as a partner is probably going to be with us for the rest of our careers. They're not looking at 2012, 2015. They're seeing this as very much a long-term reset. Whether that's direct investment in the banks may be one thing, but more just the overall role government's going to have in the economy. I think one of the other issues is we're not going to see the same type of risk-taking on Wall Street. Certainly, there's not going to be the tolerance for that. And the American consumer, we're probably going to see a new age of the frugal consumer. I think we're probably going to see saving rates go up, and we cannot rely on the consumer to be spending their way out of this crisis.
Raghuram Rajan, government as partner and less risk-taking. We've been taught in the last few decades that that's the kind of talk that means low growth. Does it or not?
Unfortunately, it could. And I think that is why we have to be very careful in the reforms. We have to understand we've been through the government route before. and it didn't work that well.
Well, so really? I mean, we had pretty good growth in the big chunks of the 50s and 60s, and I mean, there was a time after.
And then it slowed down in the 70s, yeah. And we saw the limits of growth as we reached sort of a modern globally integrated economy. And this is not to say there is no role for government. I think we went too far in the other direction over the last 10 years and abandoned all sense of government in appropriate regulation. And I think that's we need to bring the government back in some ways. But we have to be careful that we fought this battle before, and we don't want to go too much in the other direction, that is, trust government to do everything right. After all, think about the place where the biggest losses are being made. It is in the regulated financial system, which was directly under government eye. And clearly, the government took its eye off. But how can we rely on it to maintain that eye in the future? We have to do a mix which is just right. And I think this will prompt a lot of debate going forward.
Well, what a picture. Trench by trench or a big change, and off we go into a new era. Everyone's going to be watching extremely closely. Raghuram Rajan at the University of Chicago, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Diane Brady, senior editor at Business Week magazine in New York City. Diane, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
On Point is produced by Julie Jupp, Samgel Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. With help from Kathy Corman and Sam Sanders, our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.